Welcome. This is Cascade Church Portland's podcast. We exist to invite all people to join us as we follow Jesus together in bringing heaven to earth.
Hey, you guys. Good morning. My name is Sarah Swartzendruber. I'm a pastor here at Cascade. If I haven't seen you up here, which I'm looking around, I feel like most of you have seen, but if I haven't, that's because I'm downstairs. When Kurt started praying, I heard them start singing downstairs. It's like we're trading off, and it made my heart do well. It's like, oh, they made it. They're going to the next thing, right? I'm upstairs, they're downstairs. It's good. So normally I get to hang out with kids and students, which is a dream because they listen to you and they're malleable, right? And today I get to be with you guys. So I'm really excited about that. So this morning we're talking about story in John. And if you were here last week, Leroy told a story and you might be like, hey, I thought we were going in order of the Bible and now Leroy went one place and you went another place. Yes, that's correct. Leroy could preach last week and I could preach this week and we wanted our individual stories. So we went a little bit out of order. So we're going a little bit backwards and then we'll go forwards again next week if you join us then. So today we're talking about a manipulative question, which I don't know about you. I'm sure you've never asked one, like you're completely free of that. But I went through and I started brainstorming manipulative questions that I've asked, which is a dark place. I'm going to tell you that right now. I was like, ooh, I'm really awful. But I went to a memory of, I think I'm like 4 or 5 years old, and my mom's here, and so she can correct any fact of the story that's wrong. But this is how I remember the story going. So 4 or 5 year old Sarah, hard to imagine, but I was a little bit spunky and very excitable. And basically what happened is my mom went on a girls' trip with her friends, and I thought in my 4 or 5 year old brain that she must tragically miss me while she was gone. And so I plotted while she was gone that I was going to get a kitten, like really wanted a kitten. And fun fact about my family, so we had a bunny that got killed by a coyote because we lived in Arizona, like lived in our backyard. I don't know why that made sense, but it did. It lived in our backyard. And then we then had a tortoise named BJ, which was like a dog. And BJ would like live in the backyard and like scratch at the like at our door, and we'd give it lettuce. So this is like the ideal. Any of you, I know some of you parents out there are like, how do I not give my child a dog, but like kind of have a dog? It's a tortoise. That's what you do, right? So we had a tortoise, and basically, though, I really wanted a dog or a cat, and my parents, like, really weren't for it. And also, minor point, I was actually really scared of dogs and cats, so I kind of actually know why we didn't get one. But so I was determined to get a kitten, right? My mom's gone on this girls' trip, and so my dad, who is tall, but he is, you can get him, right? You can sucker him in for something if you, like, wean him down a little bit. So I felt a few options, right? My mom's gone, and I'm thinking to myself, I remember driving in the car with my dad and thinking, how do I get this cat? So option number one, I thought maybe I would just steal the cat and like bring it to my house because my best friend at the time, Kayla, they had just had kittens. And so I had easy access to cats. It wasn't just like this was going to be tricky to get the cat. I was like, no, I know how I'm going to get this cat. So the thing is the only thing that I wanted less than having a cat was a dead cat. Right? And I was aware that I may not have the skills to take care of this cat without my parents' help, right? So like option one felt like no go. Option two, I figured I could just ask my dad, which I had tried. And like my dad's allergic to cats, so he wasn't really the right person to ask. So I was like, eh, this isn't gonna go well. Option three, I figured I could convince my parents I would never be the same without this cat, and I would be the perfect angel child they had been asking for, which my older sister was, right? I was like, I'm going to be the next Beth. Like that is gonna happen. But then that also felt like a lot of commitment. So option four, at that point, I figured what I should do is if I could convince one parent that I had to have that cat, and then that parent could convince the other parent, like it would work best, right? And so I figured my mom really missed me because she had been gone for a few days, and I didn't know what she could do without me, right? How she could keep on living. And my dad, he had been single parenting for a couple of days at that point, and he's not here. So he's not really a good cook whatsoever. And like, he was kind of struggling at this point in like having two daughters. And so it felt like my dad may actually be the best one to get the cat from, right? So I tell you that story and it's funny, right? Because I'm 4 or 5 years old, right? And there are a bunch of 4 and 5 year olds downstairs who I'm sure have their own cat story that they're pulling on you all the time, right? It's like this manipulative question. I wanted a really specific outcome to come from my question. I wanted a cat, right? But I was working within a system that I understood and I knew, right? So I knew who had power in that system. I knew where my parents' role was. I knew what my role was as the child, right? I knew how much voice I did or didn't have. And today we're talking about stories about systems and questions and manipulation. And it can be complicated when we work within systems that we don't identify and we don't talk about, right? So that's what we're doing this morning. So we're talking about this story in John. John 8 is the woman caught in adultery. And to just give you context, so Augustine, who is a church father, if we do like a little church history really quick, this story is not found in the other gospels. So this is not found in Matthew, Mark, or Luke. It is found in John, right? And different people have different thoughts. So sometimes when stories are found in 3 of the gospels, but not 1, people are like, oh, that means that story's not real. We should just like forget about it, right? And other people feel like if it's in the 1, but it's not in the other 3, that actually makes the story more significant, right? There's like tons of arguments on like what should or shouldn't be in the Bible. And that's why we read it, right? It's just like a little hot mess. And so the point of that though is Augustine, who's a founding church father, he's someone that said this story specifically should not be included in the Bible. Now, why that's fascinating is if you know anything about Augustine, you know that he had an affair, essentially. He was with a woman for like 5 years and was not married to her, right? So it's not really an affair, but he was living within this relationship. And for him, his understanding of knowing God was to actually walk away from that relationship. So why do I share that? Augustine didn't like this story because it validated a sexual act that Augustine was trying to move away from. Why I think that's significant is, one, it says why we should all go to therapy, probably all the time, right? Because we bring our own lens into the Bible. And 2, I think it's significant because it says to me, Augustine, who is a well-known church father who was a part of like creating the Bible and talking through the Bible, right? He also read this story with the lens of his own story and his own life, and he put his own self into that story. So can we recognize together, we're talking about a story that talks about sin, and that is a trigger word, right? I said that if you got the newsletter. I hear sin, and I want to go on Instagram, like, immediately, because I'm like, no thanks, I'm out, right? And for others of us, like, that's like, you're like, we're talking about sin, this is amazing, which I don't know who you are, but, like, that's like your jam, and you like talking about it, right? But can we look at this story together with a lens, knowing that we're putting ourselves into the story first? So I'm going to invite you in. We're going to read it, and then we're just going to start breaking it down into 3 different chunks. So it should be on the board. It's John 8, 1 through 11. You can go ahead and pull out your Bible if you want to put it on your phone, or you can follow on the screen. So at dawn, he appeared again in the temple courts, where all the people gathered around him, and he sat down to teach them. The teachers of the law and the Pharisees brought in a woman caught in adultery. Side note, for all of those that may be a little bit younger in the room, adultery is when someone is married and is having sex with someone who is also married. Back in the screen. All right. They made her stand before the group and said to Jesus, "Teacher, this woman was caught in the act of adultery. In the law, Moses commanded us to stone such women. Now what do you say?" They were using this question as a trap in order to have a basis for accusing him. But Jesus bent down and started to write on the ground with his finger. When they kept on questioning, he straightened up and said to them, "Let any of you who is without sin be the first to throw a stone at her." Again, he stooped down and wrote on the ground. At this, those who heard began to go away one at a time, the older ones first, until only Jesus was left with the woman standing there. Jesus straightened up and asked her, "Woman, where are they? Has no one condemned you?" "No one, sir," she said. "Then neither do I condemn you," Jesus declared. "Go now and leave your life of sin." So we're going to break this down into three chunks, essentially, because I think that's the way that it's easiest to understand the story. And that the last chunk, spoiler, is my hardest chunk, right? It's like one verse and it's all about sin and it's hard. So the first chunk is kind of like where we set the scene, right? So we know that we're in the temple courts, which why that's significant is that says there's a lot of people, right? This is like the marketplace. This is where people are gathering to. And so when Jesus is teaching in the temple courts and then the woman is brought onto the scene, what's to be known is that this is a humiliating place. This is something that is meant to be seen by a lot of people. It's not something to be done quietly, right? And then we go to kind of this question that we have the teachers of the law and the Pharisees. So we've got church and state represented basically there, right? And this is the kitten manipulative question, right? That Jesus gets asked, teacher, this woman was caught in the act of adultery. And then this is the key part. In the law, Moses commanded us to stone such woman. What do you think? And why that's important is that's a challenge, right? So what's to be known is that if Jesus says to the teacher of the law and the Pharisees, if he says, no, don't stone this woman, then automatically they can argue, they know the Torah, right? They know what it says, what Moses would have said. Moses clearly would have stated that you cannot be caught in adultery. That is not okay, right? So if Jesus says, no, don't stone her, then he's in trouble with one set of people. If he says, go ahead and stone her, he's then in trouble with the Roman law because the law says that a Jewish leader may not be the person that says someone is stoned. They do not have that power. So that question's manipulative. There is no good answer that Jesus can give. In either side of that question, he's done something wrong and he gets caught and he's in trouble. We have to understand that question, what's happening in that question, in order to understand where the story's going, right? And then we have the woman, which, that's painful, right? If you read the story with empathy and you imagine being that woman in front of everyone, that shame and that guilt, right? And so the important thing that we know about this woman is, number one, we know that if you're caught in adultery, it's not just one person, right? And there is no other person present in the story. We just see one. So I think that signals to us that this is a shaming story. This is a shaming act. If this was a fair moment, right, in the system, there would have been two people, but there's one. That's the first thing to know. The second thing to know is that catching someone in adultery was really hard. I don't know how you think this, but I don't know. I think my whole life, I've just imagined this like biblical scene with this story where there's like tents and like primitive life and like you could just catch someone in adultery because like the tent flap like went up. I don't know. It's awful. I don't even want to bring you into my mind, really. But that's what I imagined most of my life when I read this story. I was like, yeah, it's like no big deal. Someone's caught in adultery. Move on. But that wasn't the case. There had to be two people that saw someone caught in adultery. And it wasn't just, and it's going to get graphic. It wasn't just that like they saw them and they're laying on the mats next to each other. The two witnesses had to catch them in the act. So to catch someone in adultery was actually really rare. That's maybe why we don't see a lot of stories around this specific offense. It wasn't something normal. And so if someone's being caught in adultery, normally what that meant is that a spy was sent, the two spies, the two witnesses, and that someone was set up. And why that's important is that we could say that this woman is a pawn in the real thing that's happening and they're trying to catch Jesus, right? That someone's life was made more important than the other. Right? And the painful part about reading this story is that the Pharisees and the teacher of law were most likely doing it in what they believed to be right and what they believed to be true, right? We've heard lines like this, like, but this is truth, right? But what they're doing is wrong. And so in the name of truth, they were trying to catch this woman in this act, but really they were trying to figure out what Jesus' response was. So then we go to this next chunk, right? And I love this because Jesus goes down on the ground, right? And it's like the scene where he's just like riding in the dirt. And people have obsessed. Kurt and I were just laughing about this. Like people want to know what Jesus is riding in the dirt, right? I love this scene of that. And so there's like different guesses that people had. Like some people think he's doing the Jesus fish and that's like why they want it on their car, which like if you have it on a car, I think that's great. I like this story. go for it, right? Or like some people think that like maybe actually Jesus is like having the first like parenting class and he's like stalling. He's just like, keep going. Like he's got like his own tactics happening right there, right? Some people think he was writing the people's names down in the dirt. Other people have said that like with the Roman judiciary system, you actually had to write your sentence out before you said it. There's like some actual really good ideas. And I like all of them, to be honest. But that's not the point. The point of the story is that we have no idea what Jesus is writing in the dirt. We just don't know. And so I think that the best way to look at it is that Jesus is stalling in whatever fashion it is. He's doing his thing in the dirt. And then he looks back up, basically. He says the famous line about, let any of you who is without sin be the first to throw a stone at her. Also, you have stones. Don't throw them at me, right? And like, then goes back down to writing and then reinstates that woman. Like, what a beautiful act that then he acknowledges the woman who's just been shamed and humiliated in front of all of these people, right? And then we see people kind of just like shift away. Now, why does that matter in 2018? I think there are two ways to look at this, right? I was with this friend recently, and he's a pastor. Not Kurt, but he is a male pastor. And he was telling me the story about preaching at his congregation. And it was about the story where the woman is washing Jesus' feet. And so he thought it would be this powerful illustration if he was on stage as Jesus and a woman from his congregation came up and washed his feet. Now, it's beautiful. It really is. Like the imagery, and for those of us that really need to see things to understand it, what a beautiful moment. But what I realized when he told that to me is that he assumed he was Jesus. And my whole life, I assumed I was that woman. Who we are and how we put ourselves into stories, it matters, right? It's just like the Augustine moment. Like we bring our own stuff into the story and how we read the Bible. So I want to take time as a congregation this morning and looking at the story, why this matters as the woman, and then why this matters as the Pharisee of the teacher of the law. Because in all of our systems, I think we've been both. I think we've been the woman, the victim, the one humiliated. And then I think sometimes we're the ones that are reinforcing the systems that are really chaotic. Right? And so if we look at this moment of this woman being humiliated, right? And I want to stand here and I want to tell you that that doesn't happen in 2018 anymore. We don't humiliate people, and especially not women. Right? But I'm a woman pastor. Right? I can't look at you and tell you that that's not happening around us. Right? And that's not just males and that's not just females. And I think if we only focus on one, we lose something, right? Because you can be a male and hear this story, have experienced being completely shamed and humiliated in front of a church. Right? There is incredible power in this story. And I look around us in a movement with Me Too. Right? And I see women and different people speaking for the first time, right? But their system to get there is an ugly system. I don't know if you've walked with someone who's trying to come forward after like a really awful sexual act, right? And that's sometimes that's one of my privileges of being a pastor is I get to do that, right? But it is ugly. And when someone has to come forward and talk about like the person that hurt them, it can be very public. Sometimes it can be very painful. They have to like trap the person in terms of like catch them in the act with doing phone calls and text messages, right? Those are really painful experiences. They're humiliating. They're reliving their pain, right? So there's like that side of it, like this moment where we see woman being humiliated. And then the other side of the story is the Pharisee and the teacher of the law. And what's complicated about them is I think we all want to be the woman because a lot of us, I think, have had that shaming and awful experience. And we're like, yes, I identify with being the victim. And then what's tricky is that we don't identify the other side of where we've hurt someone else, right? We don't identify when we've actually been a part of the system that hurt people. And the problem is that if we live in life, right, we're going to be both. We're going to be the one that's been hurt and we're also going to be the hurter. And it's painful to reflect on ourselves enough to say, like, when was I a part of the system? I think the Pharisee and the teacher of the law, they truly believed what Jesus was doing was wrong. They weren't trying to be mean or awful and manipulative, although that did happen. You know, like I want to give them the benefit of the doubt that they were trying to prove something about Jesus and they were hurting him, but they felt like it was for truth, right? They felt like it was for the right thing. I don't know about you, but I've walked away from moments of being a youth pastor, and I've walked away and thought, I just really messed up, right? I was the one that was a part of that system. Like, I did not say the right things. I shamed that person. I shouldn't have said it like that. Like, can I just, like, redo the last couple hours, right? We've all had moments where we were the ones reinforcing the system, and you just start listing them. Right? They're all around us. Like there's sexism, there's racism, there's classism, ageism. It's just like go on and on and on. Environmentalism. Like what's the thing? Right? It's very easy to point to our friend like they're doing it. Or it's very easy to poke at the system, be like there are all these things that are wrong about this system. And then it's so hard to take ownership in this system. Right? When we were at the youth retreat, we were talking about environmentalism, you guys, and I was laughing because I owned, like, recycling is hard to me. And some of you are like, I am from Portland. We recycle. I'm like, yes, I get it. It's still hard, right? It's like a hard system. It takes 5 more steps when we walk outside, and sometimes it's kind of cold, right? And like, I don't really want to do it. But yet, it's an important system that we have in place. And then we go to this final part. And it's all about leaving your life of sin. And I told you, I think this is the hardest part, right? Because Jesus reinstates this woman back into the community. He says, like, I'm not going to condemn you, which is like, yes. Can we, like, wrap up the story there and, like, call it good? That would be, like, my ideal. Be like, that's it, everyone. It's all good. That woman's walking away. She has friends. Everybody loves her. Like, it feels good, right? But I think we miss a critical part of the story if we end it there. So here's the deal with the part with go now and leave your life of sin. I think that sin is a really loaded word. And I will be the first one to tell you, I never want to preach on it. Because I think people decide what I think once things come out of my mouth, right? Oh, Sarah thinks this. It's like not helpful, right? So I think that sin is identified as anything that separates us from God. Right? And I think there's this macro view, right, where there's things that separate us from God and really hard systems. I just listed those systems for you. So like racism, classism, like those big, big systems. And then I think there's the micro, right? Then there's ourself. Like, and then what's our part of separating ourselves from God? And if you see that macro and micro, those things work together, right? I'm a part of those systems that create separation from God. And so in this final verse, when it says, go now and leave your life of sin, I think that's just as much as a message to the woman as it is to the teacher of the law and the Pharisees. It's just as much a message for me and systems that I'm poking and prodding at and I'm talking about all the time, right? I have a list for you. Things that I'm like, these are not healthy things. And then also what's my ownership in that separation from God within those systems. Here's my example. With the Me Too movement, there were, if you have heard of Larry Nassar, I don't even know if I'm saying his name right, but the doctor that came out with the Olympics, the gymnastics doctor or whatever, and there was, I think there's 144 women, 144 women that come forward and say, like, this man has done awful things. And I have to be honest with you, as each one came out, I inserted girls I've worked with or students I've been with or my friends. Right? I inserted ourselves into those stories, and I was angry. I was like, 144, that is nuts. Like, no more. No more. And every woman that came forward, I was like, yes, go, go. Right? Like, I loved following that news story because it was like within my own system, it was backing up all my thoughts. It's like, Jesus is not in that. Jesus is not in that. Right? It's like, I just like went on this track and as everyone came forward, it honestly felt good in this sick way, right? It's like, we can prove to you that you're wrong. I can prove to you what you've done is wrong to these women. Right? But what happened is, and then a couple weeks later, Garrison Keillor, who's the Prairie Home Companion, right? Or Matt Lauer, whoever that person is. But Garrison Keillor was the one that stuck out to me, which is this, not lit. He's coming. This is actually a nicer picture than I think he really looks like in real life, but we gave him the benefit of the doubt. So I think that was key, though, is that Garrison Keillor, when he came out, I have a lot of memories of listening to him as a kid, right? I have like memories all through like my childhood and adult life or whatever of his voice in our family room, right? And I remember listening to him. And for me, Garrison Keillor's voice is a voice of safety. He's a voice of like comfort. It's a voice of being known. It's a voice of love. It's a voice of like my mom and dad and my sister, like really holy and intimate spaces for me and memories. And so why I bring this up is when Garrison Keillor gets taken off of Prairie Home Companion, right? Within the same system that Larry Nassar gets taken off, which I was angry in, when Garrison Keillor gets taken off, I was like, I don't want this. Like I almost wanted to like stop listening because it was so painful of the place of safety for me all of a sudden would be the place of pain. And that's what I mean when I talk about systems, that we're a part of these systems. And sometimes we're comfortable with something going, being critiqued or going wrong because it already backs up our own arguments. And sometimes we're unwilling to be a part of those problems. We're unwilling to see our side of it as well. My hope and my prayer is that when we read the story of the woman caught in adultery, that we wouldn't just be throwing stones, right? But instead we'd be picking up the stones as well and saying, like, what are we doing in this system? How are we a part of the problems? Because I can critique all day long. I really can. I can manipulate. I can ask questions. I can make my arguments. I can do all those things. And sometimes I think that has to happen. Sometimes I really believe there is justice and there are problems. I am not diminishing this woman caught in adultery and the humiliation and the shame she felt. That was an incredibly painful experience. What I'm saying is this morning, can we look at ourselves this week and say, yes, I've been this woman caught in adultery, or I've been this woman shamed or this man shamed in these experiences, but I've also been the one that's created the experiences. And when we start reflecting and really asking those questions, I think that's where the ugliness comes. And what are we going to do? And so my prayer in that moment is that you and I and we would be willing to go leave our life of sin. I'm going to go ahead and pray for us. Lord, I'm grateful for stories that help us better understand who you are. God, I'm grateful for this image of this woman who's been humiliated. Lord, not because I think that it's not significant, but because I think it helps me understand your love and your hope. Lord, I'm grateful for the empathy for the teachers of the law and the Pharisees. Because, God, I need that empathy for myself when I'm these people. Lord, I pray we would not just live in our own sounding boxes or live within the places that tell us what we want to hear, but we would be willing to ask the hard questions and reflect. Lord, we love you. In your name, amen.